This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Huge thanks to Amy there for the news. She'll be back at 12 o'clock. Before we go any further, though, also huge thanks to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week on a Monday morning. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday morning here on RTRFM from 9 in the a.m. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me in the studio is Joni Boyd. How's it going, Joni?
Yeah, good. How are you, Ray?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, a little bit, good. You know, a little bit tired from a weekend, but, you know, ready to get into all the news and do all the things as we've been doing for a long time here on Mondays on RTRFM.
For a little while.
Yeah, just a little while. It's been a bit. Brahma's also in the studio sneezing and sniffing and keeping up the positive vibes. Hope you're having a good Monday morning. On today's show, we're going to be covering a whole range of subjects. We're going to be talking about the ongoing crisis at Melbourne's Park Hotel, there where some 22 refugees who originally came from offshore detention camps in Manus, Papua New Guinea, and also in Nauru. They've been in the Park Hotel since December, and there's recently been a COVID outbreak in the hotel. 22 of them now have COVID-19, and one of those refugees has been hospitalised. There's been ongoing protests demonstrating solidarity and support with the refugees there, and really pointing to the inadequate protocols and really facilities that have led to this outbreak. So a little later in the show, we're going to be chatting to a regular, I guess, guest on Indie Media, Ian Rintoul. Ian is from the Refugee Action Collective.
We'll also hear some of the speeches from the recent rally for justice for Joyce Clark, the Yamaji woman who was shot by a WA police constable, shot and killed back in 2019. Last Thursday, Indigenous activists gathered and their allies gathered out the front of State Parliament House to protest the verdict. And we've got some of those speeches and,
We're also going to be up first on the show. We're going to be speaking to a longtime peace activist, anti-nuclear activist, and a bit of a local legend, Joe Valentine. Joe and a bunch of folks were down in Point Perrin yesterday, as there is currently a British nuclear submarine visiting, just doing the rounds down in Fremantle. And obviously, there's been a long campaign from groups such as the Fremantle Anti-Nuclear Group and others to oppose the visits by nuclear submarines in our port city. So we're going to be catching up with Joe to talk about the existence of this sub, what it means, and how it connects, I guess, to Australia's sort of military industrial complex and the whole nuclear issue. And this is the Indie Media Show with Ray, Joni and Brahma. Now, while many people were out getting involved in the Halloween festivities yesterday, a different kind of horror show was unfolding with the visit of the first of the UK nuclear submarines to Fremantle. This is a fairly, new development in some ways, as it is the first of the subs to be visiting Fremantle since the US, UK and Australia set up their trilateral security partnership known as AUKUS. On the line now, we have a longtime peace activist and anti-nuclear activist, Joe Valentine. Thanks very much for speaking to us this morning, Joe.
Oh, that's fine, Ray. Thank you.
Now, yesterday, a group of citizens and anti-nuclear activists and folks gathered down at Point Perrin. Can I start by just asking you, why were you setting up a presence down there at Point Perrin and declaring your, I guess, opposition to this visit by this UK nuclear submarine?
Well, this is the first manifestation of the new AUKUS agreement, which is awkward to say and absolutely atrocious and abominable without any consultation whatsoever. our government has gone again into a defence, so-called, military partnership with the United States and Great Britain, which have led us into so many wars with disastrous results. Why would we even think about going nuclear? Australia would be the only country without nuclear power and without nuclear weapons to acquire nuclear submarines. It sends all the wrong signals to our Pacific neighbours. According to the SPINFIS, that is the South Pacific Nuclear Free Treaty Zone, and also ASEAN, there's a nuclear non-proliferation clause in that. We're sending all the wrong messages to our neighbours. It's just abominable. And the government says, well, it won't lead to us acquiring nuclear weapons or even having a nuclear industry. But that is the thin end of the wedge. It would certainly lead to a nuclear industry being established in Australia. And these nuclear reactors use highly enriched uranium, which means that there'll be more fissile material, nuclear weapons possible material around the world to create these new reactors. It's just completely the wrong message for our time.
Now, a part of this this agreement is, of course, the sort of the submarine program. And there's been a significant amount of media around that, especially, of course, with the French government and Macron being quite upset with the Australian government cancelling their submarine deals. As you're saying there, it does seem to really open the door for nuclear-powered, you know, obviously submarines, but and other sorts of nuclear power. But I guess if we could talk a little bit more about what it means in terms of the geopolitics, and the fact that it comes at a time when the US is very wary of China, and there's been, you know, quite not even secret, quite open sort of declarations of having to confront the sort of the rise of Chinese hegemony. What do you think it says in terms of our position in Australia, and I guess this role that we've taken historically as being a bit of a lapdog for the US? Do you think that really solidifies our role as you know, a part of the American sort of military, or the American Empire, as some like to call it, here in Australia?
Well, absolutely it does. It's very sad that our sovereignty seems to have gone out the window completely with this kind of reckless decision. We don't need to be a lackey of the United States. I mean, Australia is so fortunate in having a sea gap right around it. We're the only island continent in the world that is completely independent and peaceful in our region. And yet we blow it time and time again by lining ourselves up with the United States. Clearly, this is about containment of China. And again, how crazy is that when they're our largest trading partner? Not that I agree with everything the Chinese government does, but they could look at us and say they don't agree with our treatment of Indigenous people, for example. So there, no nation is perfect. And yes, they're our greatest trading partner. Why would we be lining ourselves up so obviously with the United States against China in the Indo-Pacific? It really is a very bad move. And it all started in 2011 when Barack Obama, President of the United States, came here and declared that US Marines would be coming in and out of Darwin. Julia Gillard was the Prime Minister at the time, and she did lots of good things, but this was not one of them. She just let that go, did not challenge it at all. First step, US Marines on Australian soil. And ever since then, we have been further and further embedded in the US nuclear and warfighting nightmare. We've just come out of Afghanistan, for goodness sake, 20 years of a stupid war, which has cost an extraordinary amount in human and environmental terms, not to mention financially, of course. And, you know, we look like we're just going to do it again. And this is all in secret. So we should be having greater scrutiny on the government rather than secrecy coming from the government. No consultation whatsoever. Now, it hasn't been approved even by the US Congress, this deal. But according to Dutton, they're very, very keen for us to share their nuclear technology, both the US and the UK, with Australia. So again, we're being set up as the bunnies in the Indo-Pacific region to do the dirty work for these powers that still want to flex their nuclear muscles, and that could have devastating effects. One other thing I want to mention is that nuclear submarine accidents do happen. There's a great list of them. One of the most recent being a collision between a United States nuclear submarine with another vessel in 2005. And in 2001, a US submarine surfaced underneath a Japanese training vessel and people were killed. You know, I mean, this happens. 9 nuclear-powered submarines are on the ocean floor, including 2 from the US. Eventually, there'll be a release of radiation because the salt water will corrode the containment vessels. What do they do if there's an accident at Garden Island with a nuclear submarine? Where's the nuclear safety plan? The only port safety plan that exists, as far as I know, is that if there's a problem with reactors on board a vessel while it's stationed at Garden Island, is to tow it out, up gauge roads, out beyond Rottnest, find a deep ocean trench, and sink the damn thing. Now, that is not a good look. That is not being responsible for the lives of the people involved. And when these submarines have died and, you know, been put down at the ocean floor due to accident, often all the crew is in there and, you know, never to surface again. I mean, it would be a dreadful, dreadful way to go, I think, being trapped in a submarine with nuclear radiation possible as well. They're just not safe. Safe and not sensible.
Joni here. When these submarines sink and, you know, they corrode away and the radiation leaks out into the ocean, like, what kind of environmental impact does that have?
Well, it could have huge. Now, the ones that are on the bottom of the ocean floor at the moment have not been there all that long, and it would probably take quite a while for the erosion of the containment vessels to absolutely be broken. So we haven't had any measurement of radiation leaking from these submerged vessels thus far, but it will happen. And who knows how dreadful that could be for the immediate environment on the ocean floor, but also spreading further on the currents that the ocean sends around the world. You know, there's no way of knowing that any radiation leaking from submerged nuclear reactors that have had accidents will not spread around the world. So the results could be devastating for everybody everywhere. It's just a risk that we don't need to take. So anything nuclear does not make us safer, certainly doesn't give us more security, but does pose an extraordinary amount of possible risk.
We're speaking to Jo Valentine, longtime anti-nuclear activist and peace activist. Jo, you have been involved in this campaign for a long time, back all the way to the People for Nuclear Disarmament days. And, of course, many of our listeners would remember the ongoing protests down at Fremantle Wharf and through the streets of Fremantle, really calling for an end to nuclear subs visiting Fremantle. I guess looking at it from a local issue, do you imagine people are going to be... Because I imagine a lot of people just aren't even aware that this is happening, you know, given the world we live in these days, where people are distracted by other things. Do you imagine that a lot of people are going to be quite angry and upset that these subs are coming back to Fremantle, in this case at Garden Island, and potentially putting us all at risk?
Oh, I'm sure. I think that the public is very concerned if they know about it. As you say, there are so many other distractions, and really our government should be paying attention to the things that are of immediate concern to Australians, like COVID and like our health systems cracking up and like climate change. I mean, you know, the government has let itself be distracted, or it's trying to distract the Australian people with this. And we're meant to be very happy about the fact that 2 nuclear weapons nations are wanting to share their nuclear technology with us, as though that's a good thing. It's absolutely crazy. So over the years, yes, there have been many protests about warships of any kind visiting Fremantle Port. The nuclear-powered aircraft carriers are stationed out in gauge roads because they are too big and too dangerous. It's recognised, too dangerous to come right into the port. So when the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers have arrived, people get shuttled back and forth to have their R&R. Now, these poor submariners on the British vessel down in Garden Island at the moment. I don't know whether they're actually able to get offshore. We saw a bus going in there yesterday, which suggested to me that maybe a busload of submariners was coming out to have a little drive around. But what about quarantine for them? Unanswered questions. So many unanswered questions. We just don't know. But I want to tell you, there's one little story that years ago, a French nuclear submarine came into the port. And this is interesting in light of the fact that the French are so furious with Australia at the moment. This has been so badly handled. But we had the Pearl, a French nuclear submarine coming into a Garden Island, and we made a very big papier-mâché submarine, about 3 metres long, and had the great pleasure of smashing it to bits at the gates of Garden Island. So I think that's just a little irony that at the moment the French are so furious with us, but we'll have a go at them too if they bring nuclear subs our way. Probably not likely in the near future, but the British here already, it is a worry. Now, these nuclear subs that are promised are probably not going to surface. Well, they're not going to be built until the 2040s, but I reckon they'll be obsolete by the time they're operational. Drone warfare is increasingly able to pinpoint what's going on underneath the surface of the ocean. Soon, obsolete submarines generally will be obsolete, I think, because drones will be able to pinpoint their location and target them. Why are we wasting billions and billions of dollars on nuclear submarines when we have so many other pressing issues to deal with right now, right here, including especially attention to global warming? I hope ScoMo gets a drubbing at Glasgow, because really our government deserves to be so embarrassed about that. And yet he will be crowing about this new relationship with the UK and the US as though we haven't been there before. It's just outrageous on so many levels. What the government should be doing right now, if they say it's not going to lead to a nuclear industry, don't believe it. If they say it's not going to lead to further nuclearisation in Australia, don't believe that either. But let them prove that by signing up to the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. If we're really serious about this and we don't want Australia to have nuclear weapons, the government should be signing and ratifying that United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
We've been speaking to long-time anti-nuclear and peace activist Jo Valentine. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning, Jo.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
A warning to Aboriginal listeners that this following segment uses names of people who have died. Last month, the WA police constable who fatally shot Yamatji woman Joyce Clark in 2019 was acquitted of murder by an all-white jury. On Thursday just gone, Yamatji activists and their allies gathered at State Parliament to protest this verdict. They were met by a heavy, intimidating police presence, with cops standing mere metres away from the rally speakers. There was about 50 of them there and counting. Activists spoke about many issues around JC's death, including the injustice of the trial, the lack of medical and psychological care in the prison system, and the launching of a class action seeking justice for black deaths in custody. Here we have several speakers from the protest, starting with Yamatji man and relative of Joyce, Sandy Davis.
Every time we have a tragedy in our state, we come to the steps of Parliament and we go home, we say nothing, we do nothing until the next time comes round. So the government and police and justice system ignores us because they think we're going to go away once we've spilled our grief. Not this time. Not this time. I just want to give you a couple of examples. In the month we've been down here, a man with a sword or a machete was tasered by the police to disarm him. A man was shot out here and killed. But before the police shot him and killed him, they mazed him and tasered him.
War.
But in Charlton, from the time he got to the front of his car, it took him 3 seconds to run up and shoot that girl dead. If we couldn't, with the video evidence and the evidence that was given, I think it's as plain as the nose on your face that there's not a jury in this state who will ever have the nerve to convict and find a police officer guilty.
Why? Why?
Because if it couldn't happen with that particular police officer who shot Joyce Clark, and the evidence and the videos, we got video evidence, and he's still walking around.
Shame! Why didn't they have body cams on?
You know, I first started at the Gooroodoora Whinjidoora Club Rooms in 1977 with my first 44 years, and through the years, there's been a lot of tragedies and a lot of things happened. And we hoped and hoped that things would get better. We hoped and hoped things would get better. But just in recent times, my niece, Miss June, dragged around the police cell like a rag doll. Mr. Ward, baked and roasted like a leg of meat. Can you imagine the pain and suffering that man went through while he was dying? And now, what happens now? They shoot a girl who was 5 foot nothing, and we're lucky to go 30 kilos ringing wet. But they took the opportunity, one particular police officer took the opportunity to shoot that girl dead. We want change. We don't want to talk. We don't want the government to come and ask us what we want or how we do it. We demand. We demand that justice, when Aboriginal people go to court, that there has to be people in that court who have medical background on mental health and depression. Because what happens is, when they go into court, the magistrate doesn't have a clue and has no medical background. The lawyers don't have no medical background. But because they're Aboriginal, they must be drunk, they must be on the drugs, and we need to put them out at Greniff.
Shame!
Same as the police. They don't have any medical background. What we are demanding from the government today, we want to ensure that police stations and courthouses have medical people, psychologists who have a medical background, who can assess the conditions of the patients that are in there, because that's what they are, their patients. If people think that our family and extended family are going to go home and sit on our ass and fret for the next 10 years, this government's in for a shock. We want change. We want change.
For this last 4 weeks I just done here in Perth with my baby sister. No justice out of that, you know. At the end of the day, white man can shoot a black man. That's no fair. And it's been going on for how long? How long for us to stand here today as a family to fight for our sister? What happened with all the rest? Well, they covered and swept under the carpet too. These other deaths in custody, you know, before my sister's here today. You know, we all got to be together on this. Otherwise, this man up here, he already overruled us. You know, government not there for us. He stabbed at us in the back. Long time. When they took us away from our parents, precisely. You know, this is why I'm here standing strong. For her. My sister needs justice. My sister deserves to rest in peace in a proper manner. In a culture way, that's our way. He got to rest properly. In our way, old people, ancestors, they're not happy. They will never be happy until this man who pulled the trigger, he got to be accounted for. He has to be accounted for what he did to my sister. He fucking killed my sister. And he can walk free. He can walk free on this land. Nah, that's not fair. No fair guy in all this. The government is the overruler. He's been overruling us for years. White man's rules. Nah, black man rule was first. Black man law was before white man law. Before white man, black man ruled. But what we are bringing back into spears and boomerangs and our kids to be dressed up in ancestor way. But we can do it because it's in our blood, never ever changed. It's always been in our blood. I'm just angry with the fact that we're here today at the parliament and nobody wants to answer to black man for what this white man got away with. He never shot a kangaroo, a molo. He shot a fucking human being. We're all human beings. We all fucking pain. We all bleed the same. You know, it's just corruptcy, and that's not right. Gladys shouldn't do that to black man. Corruptcy. We need a fair go out of all this. And it starts with all of us here as one. To talk to this man up here, he got a lot to say behind his doors and walls. Nobody wants to talk.
Hey, Mark McGill!
Yeah, we want the parliament, the white man to come out and face us. As Aboriginal people, you know, you let a man walk away free. Cowards, and shame on yous. We'll never get it unless we stand together. And it's not going to stop from here. We're taking this to Canberra next. We're taking it to the next big parliament house. How you like that? We'll march all over Australia for JC, for my sister. We'll march all over Australia. Thank you.
He died just like Shadina. So this murder charge was a historic charge because we know that never before had an Aboriginal person murdered by the police been charged since the Forest River Massacre of 1926. But, you know, walking into that court and seeing that all jury of no Aboriginal people, my heart sank because I can tell you when I got out of law school in the 1990s, I saw the killings of Aboriginal people by white people. And I saw what happened, and there wasn't any justice in the courts before those juries. And to come here and to see so many police, and we know this is the riot squad here today. This is Aboriginal women, girls being murdered. This was an Aboriginal woman with a disability and a mental illness released from prison with no care and support. And the McGowan government has invested $1.86 billion, not million, into increasing policing. What's left for our women? Nothing. Nothing but cop killers. And I heard all the evidence, and he is not innocent. And for the police commissioner to call him an innocent man is a disgrace and an insult to all Aboriginal people. Shame. There's no justice here. Minister White, before he went off to join the mining companies and make himself $1 million a year, had consultations with Aboriginal people about an Office of the Statutory Aboriginal Advocate, an advocate for us to speak up about this systemic and structural discrimination in this state. We have no such body. We have more deaths in custody here. We have more incarceration than any other country. And late last year, the McGowan government passed a new law that we weren't told about, and it was called the High Risk Serious Offenders Act. The same week that this man, who we can't name because he's been protected, was released by this jury, that same week, Peter Garlett had a constitutional challenge to the High Risk Serious Offenders Act. In the same court, his crime was stealing $20 and a necklace, and he received 3.5 years for that crime, and ending the 3.5 year sentence, he was placed under indefinite detention order. Meaning he doesn't get to go free. He did not kill anybody. He did not assault anybody. And his childhood offences were used against him. He was raised under the care of the state from 9 years old, where he was taken from here to the top of the state, away from his family. So yes, this is an ongoing genocide against our people. No, we won't be quiet. Police Commissioner, you should stand down. You have made a mockery of your apology. You are not fit to govern. This is an indictment on policing here today, the riot squad, to speak up, to air our freedom of expression, our rights, to speak against race discrimination, to speak against racist killings that are ongoing in this country, and they have brought so many out for us. And where is the Indigenous Minister? Shame on you, Minister Dawson. Shame on you, McGowan government, gloating in your billions of dollar surplus while our people are being killed and dying on the streets. And I stand in solidarity with the family of Bernie and all the families, and we will take this to the United Nations treaty bodies, because racist killers can get away with it in this rotten state.
The legal system in Western Australia, they're not here for our people. They never have been. They like locking us up. No one will ever be found guilty of any death of any of our people. Nor will they, until things are changed. We've got to say what is to do with our people. No jury until our people are a part of it. A man and woman are on that jury. Otherwise, we don't want no jury. Just keep knocking their juries back. Knock their juries back. Let it be 100, 200, 300 people through. Nothing. No one held accountable. A little boy got to grow up. He lost his mum. No one's accountable. What does that little boy will grow up and think? They can kill our people? Yes, they can. They're legalised to kill our people. Once they take on that badge and that gun, they are legal killers. And they are the biggest gang. They are a gang. They're the biggest gang. The bikies have nothing on them. The criminal element has nothing on them. They are a gang.
Thank you, everybody here. The Whadjuk people, the Yamaji and Noongar, and everybody that's come together, the human family. Western Australia is the mother of all jailers. From a racialised lens, it incarcerates its First Nations people, not only highest in this country, but in the world. Can you imagine that? In the world. Highest jailing rate in the world. In terms of deaths in custody, it remains what it was in the 1980s. In the 1990s. In 1988, I remember Mavis Pat, the late Mavis Pat. She said to me at the time, I hold out hope, Jerry. I hold out hope that the Royal Commission will change things. Well, Mavis is no longer. And her son, John Pat, is no longer. And nothing has changed. Western Australia continues in terms of rate and in terms of toll, the highest in the nation in terms of death in custody. In the last several years, we have launched 17 legal actions for redress for affected families on an individuated basis. But that is a straw in the bail. We're now going collective. We have launched one class action with powerful lawyers for Banksia Hill to come to an end, a children's prison to be abolished and other alternatives in place, humaneness, compassion, love and human decency for all our children, the most vulnerable, whether they're black, brown or white. And we launched another legal action, and we met with the Minister today of Corrective Services and the government. Another legal action has been brought forward, and that is to end black deaths in custody.
Now let me tell you something, you mob. The Banksia Hill, there is a class action open that's happening right now. 500 people have joined it. That is being represented by the Palm Island lawyers. They are spearheading it. Well, let me tell you what happened last week on Thursday. The superintendent is no longer at Banksia Hill. That's how powerful our voices are.
Some voices of Indigenous activists outside Parliament House last Thursday. There was a rally protesting the lack of justice for Yamaji woman JC when the WA police constable who fatally shot her in 2019 was found not guilty last month by an all-white jury. You are listening to Indie Media on RTR FM 92.1.
Half of the refugees who are currently incarcerated in a Melbourne hotel, the Park Hotel, now have COVID-19. And advocates are saying that Australian officials are very much to blame for this worsening and COVID crisis that's currently taking place. 22 of them now have COVID-19, and one of the refugees has been hospitalised. To find out about the unfolding situation, a little earlier today I spoke to Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Collective, and I simply asked Ian exactly what's going on at the Park Hotel and why are these refugees in this current situation.
The truth is we simply don't know how the infection got into Park Hotel, and that's one of the problems. In any other instance, there would have been a lot of effort made to actually identify the source of the infection, so not just so that other close contacts and stuff, can be notified, but to indicate where the breach actually came and what could be done about it. We don't know whether that they have attempted to identify it. What we do know is sort of nothing has changed at the hotel. If they have identified, it's clear it has to come from outside. So it's going to be, a Serco guard. It's going to be a border force. It's going to be, one or other of those contractors has brought it from outside the hotel. There's simply no other way it got there. So that's kind of one of the indications of kind of the failures that there have been, and there have been systematic failures. I mean, I don't think I could go through them in the short time, that we've got. But right from the get-go, when people first notified with symptoms, that they were given Panadol, even though it was quite clear in any other circumstances, they would have been isolated. But it was 2 days after they, first presented with symptoms before they were isolated and tested. And it was only after that positive test came back, and that was 5 days after they first presented with symptoms, that everyone else in the hotel, was tested. So right from the get-go, there have been serious problems with protocols, with what would be normal procedure in any other place except the detention centre. And then, as you alluded to, one of the very, very serious problems is that the people who did turn out to be positive were simply placed on level one of the hotel. So you're effectively housing people who were positive with people who, at that stage were still negative in the same hotel. It's not a quarantine hotel. It's not a facility designed to actually separate, to properly quarantine people, whether they were all positives or otherwise, but to ensure that other people were safe in the hotel. That simply, didn't happen. And the consequence is that there are now 22 who are, and that's just the numbers of refugees that we know of. We've got every reason to believe, because it's starting to show up in terms of staff absences, that perhaps more than half or up to half or more of the staff at the Park Hotel similarly have been infected.
Ian, as you said, this isn't a quarantine hotel. Refugees have been there since December. Some of these refugees, for instance, Salah Mustafa, he spent 8 years within Australia's immigration detention regimes, both offshore on Nauru, in Sydney's Villawood Detention Centre, and now in the past few months he's been confined to the Park Hotel in Carlton. What, I guess, a sort of fairly obvious question, but one that a lot of people probably don't know the answer for: why are these people languishing in this hotel that clearly doesn't have the protocols and the facilities to deal with situations such as COVID-19? Why are they here, and why, I guess, is the government forcing them to live in these conditions in such terrible circumstances?
Well, I think you can only understand that if you understand that they are, victims of offshore detention policy. And what we're seeing in Australia is a small indication of what they have endured, in PNG and Nauru. And the reason that these particular group of people are not in the community, other people who have similarly been medically transferred from, Madison Nauru, is simply because it's a policy decision that, the government has said that people who are in offshore detention won't be resettled in the community. And in spite of the fact that some people have been effectively resettled, either with bridging visas or, community detention in the community, in order to maintain, the policy position, they haven't released these people. I mean, 80 odd people got out in between December and February, December last year, February this year. But this last group of, 80 odd people, it's just sheer bloody mindedness that the government's policy comes before issues of either their safety or community safety. So the conditions in the hotel, well, again, I just think the government has got away with it because they can. They still put out press releases saying that the COVID treatment in the hotel has been done consultation with Victorian authorities. We know that consultation has been minimal, if it existed, if at all existent. because the Victorian authorities have now written to the Home Affairs to ask, you know, well, what are the procedures in the Park Hotel? How does the Home Affairs explain the spread of infection and the lack of protocols? But you know, we need an inquiry. We're not going to get the answers to find out exactly what the government has done and hasn't done with this particular group of people. What we do know is that they have, created the circumstances in which the Park Hotel is a COVID incubator.
We're speaking to Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Collective. Ian, you mentioned there before that, many of these people have spent time in PNG and offshore detention, and you're also talking there about the need for an inquiry. Now, today there has been an inquiry, the State Coroner's report into the medical response to the death of Omid Masolomi, who self-harmed in Nauru and subsequently self-immolated and passed away. I believe you were taking part in a presence and a protest outside the coroner's report. The Queensland State Coroner has found that the medical response to Mr. Omid Mussolini, who set himself on fire, was inferior and inadequate. Can I just ask you, I guess briefly give us, our listeners, a little bit of background to this case and what the coroner's report really indicates in terms of the medical response to this incident on Nauru, and I guess more broadly to the events that led up to this and how they could have been avoided.
Sat into findings this morning, right. Look, I think there are two takeaway things. I mean, the situation in Nauru, obviously shouldn't have even, been there. The people that Omid and his wife were found to be, refugees. They'd been detained, almost 1,000 days, before Omid set fire to himself. They were, as I said, found to be refugees, but which the coroner did insist upon, which is a point that's been made, over and over again over the issue of refugees for the last, 20 odd years, that it is the uncertainty and the question of the indefinite detention, which is the main thing, the single most important thing, which preys on the mental health of people who are subject to indefinite detention. And one of the coroner's recommendations, although we've got no reason to believe the government will take any notice whatsoever, was that people who are found to be refugees should have a clear timetable about the possibilities of resettlement. But there was no resettlement, for Omid and others on Nauru in 2014 or in 2016 when the incident took place. So, I mean, that was one of the very, very strong recommendations that came out, that it is the uncertainty that creates despair and desperation and creates the single most important cause of the mental health problems. And, the truth is there are people who are in Park Hotel who were on Nauru when Omid set fire to himself. So 5 years on from that incident, there's people still don't have any certainty. There's still no security. And it still preys on people's mental health, as we just see with the ongoing incidents of attempted suicide and self harm. I think the second thing which came out was just the lack of the medical facilities. I mean, I disagree. The coroner said that there have been some improvements in Nauru. They're marginal, in my opinion, and we'll probably need another inquiry to actually prove that. But what he clearly indicated was just that there were no adequate facilities on Nauru when Omid burned himself. But that was also something that had been pointed out by people there and by the refugee movement since Nauru was set up. And yet we heard over and over again, we still hear over and over again, that the facilities on PNG or in Nauru were roughly comparable or broadly comparable to any that might be experienced in Australia. The coroner was very clear, accepted the medical evidence, that the facilities on Thursday Island were far better than the facilities on Nauru. So that's, I think, perhaps we can, put an end to that lie that we get from the government about the nature of the facilities that actually existed. I think the other thing, which I also didn't get a chance to really contest with the coroner, but you know, he said that Omid couldn't have been evacuated, you know, any earlier. That is just not true. I mean, people who sat on Nauru or people who, like myself who were in Australia at the time getting, you know, minute-by-minute reports about Omid's condition, and I made the point at the time, look, if Omid had been, you know, a lone yachtswoman, you know, in the, you know, caught in the seas, you know, towards Antarctica, there would have been RAF planes gone out, searched and provide whatever, you know, was necessary. If the government knew that an air ambulance couldn't get there inside 24 hours, then they've got the resources to get, you know, the medical attention, medical support that was needed for Omid. There's simply no excuse to be found in, you know, that somehow or other an air ambulance, you know, wasn't available. They would have moved heaven and earth if it had been an Australian contractor, if it had been an IHMS doctor, you know, then you can bet your life that they would have been evacuated from, you know, from Nauru. Now, Omid was a victim of the, you know, of not just a lack of facilities, was a victim of the policy that was created offshore detention. It quite deliberately didn't have the medical facilities. It, you know, it didn't have, you know, the uncertainty that was created by that, that surrounds indefinite detention, are deliberate aspects of government policy which remain, you know, firmly in place.
Just finally, Ian, we did see back in March, you know, I guess some small victory with the release of the 50 men detained at Kangaroo Point Immigration Centre in Brisbane. Very similar, I guess, situation in some ways to the Park Hotel crisis that's now unfolding. Is there any indication, I guess, you know, looking at at least the release of those 50 men from Kangaroo Point, is there any indication that there is hope for those in Park Hotel and more broadly hope for all those refugees languishing in offshore detention or in so-called community detention or hotel detention here in Australia?
Well, I think the whole history indicates that there's hope. There's hope, Ray. I mean, I don't think there's any alternative for the Australian government but to release these people. And the latest round of protests, both inside and outside the Park Hotel, will be, you know, another step to winning their freedom. I can't, you know, tell you when we're going to win that, when the guys inside are going to win that, but win it we will. The tragedy is that the cost in the meantime is, you know, is enormous, as you know, as Omid's case makes very, very clear. It's, you know, with the circumstances, whether you're inside the Park Hotel, there've been attempted suicides there. There've been instances of self-harm because the same desperation and certainty preys on their minds. These are people who were brought from Manus and Nauru to Australia a bit over two years ago. Most of the people have seen their release. I mean, again, they've not just created a COVID incubator, but they've created the worsened circumstances, and that was experienced by Omid on Nauru, to actually undermine, their mental health. So the costs are quite optimistic in that respect. You know, we will, in the same way as we got most people off Manus and Nauru to Australia. We haven't got permanent visas for them yet, but I'm sure we will get the, you know, people out of Park Hotel.
That was Ian Rintel from the Refugee Action Collective speaking to us earlier today. And we've very much run out of time this week on the Indie Media Show. Thank you so much for listening. Joni, thanks so much for coming in.
Always good to be here.
We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. Keep it locked, though, as coming up very, very shortly after the news with Amy is Rianne Todhunter is going to take you out to lunch, all of your new music needs. As I said, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. In the meantime, have a great week. And as we say every week on Indie Media,
don't hate the media,
become
the media.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?